She used television to distract herself from nagging questions about why she didn't have a partner or a tighter friendship network, only to find that it left her feeling empty. I used to watch a lot of TV, but that was a real fast way to get depressed and lonely. Although she realized that she needed to get off her couch and out into the world, she had trouble getting motivated. She would wait for the phone or doorbell to ring, but they didn't. It took me a long time to figure out that it wasn't going to happen the way it happened in college. People didn't just drop by, and it was just harder to make friends. Everybody's busy and nobody really has any time. And I was scared to put myself out there. For 3 years I would call my brother every weekend to complain. I'd have nothing to do. When Kimberly reached her mid-30s, something snapped. I got sick of being lonely, she says. It took a long time, but something happened, and I grew up and transformed. Kimberly insists that the decisive moment came when she opted to move out of her apartment and buy a place of her own. It was a stretch, financially and psychologically, but it was important because it signaled that she was no longer waiting for a man to help her jump into a new life stage. She was doing it independently, on her own terms. I hadn't settled down with anyone. I hadn't fallen in love, and I had to stop and take a look at that. I never thought I'd buy an apartment alone. I sort of resisted it the whole way through. I didn't want to hang curtains by myself. I'd always thought I would do it with a partner and a lover, and so that was hard. Immediately, the change felt good. So good, in fact, that Kimberly kept changing things. She decided to remake her body, got a personal trainer, began biking on weekends with a group, and lost 30 pounds. She renovated her apartment, opening up space so that she could throw dinner parties. She reached out to people, inviting friends out, putting herself on the line. Her big breakthrough was placing a profile on an online dating site, something she'd been terrified to do before. She worried someone she knew would recognize her and that they would confirm her fear that I was a loser because I wasn't already in love. That fear diminished as Kimberly settled into her new life. I got more confident in who I was, so I was less afraid to talk to people, less afraid to make friends, and less afraid to go out and be adventurous. She was dating, but she stopped going out on second and third dates with men who didn't really interest her, because she no longer felt as insecure and she didn't need everyone to like her. She cut back on her TV viewing and kept herself from falling into a vicious cycle of depression, social withdrawal, and loneliness. She quit her job and started freelancing, which she'd wanted to do for years. Then Kimberly made an even bolder move. She reached out to Single Mothers by Choice, an organization that supports women who want to become parents but refuse to settle for an unsatisfying partner, and began to consider having a child on her own. Like so many single women in their late 30s, Kimberly couldn't avoid hearing the booming alarm bells on her biological clock, and she decided to confront the issue head on. As Kimberly saw it, she had become so strong and self-sufficient while living alone that she could now handle the responsibility of caring for another. To be sure, it wouldn't be the kind of domestic partner she had imagined when she turned 30, and she was hardly certain that she would go through with the process, since having a child would make finding a man even more difficult. But Kimberly no longer felt sorry for herself. "I'm lucky," she says. "I have some money and I have family support. I think I'm going to figure it out." People who live alone are well aware that, however enriching it may be, becoming a single parent is also the most challenging way to get domestic companionship. There is another, more popular alternative for people who want to live alone but also need someone to care for or something to help stave off loneliness: getting a pet. Animal companions are a common feature of Western cultures. In 2004, writes the historian Catherine Greer, more than 60% of American households contained pet animals, 36% included children. An essay in a public health journal reports that U.S. pet ownership rates are typical of developed countries around the world. Examples of dog, cat, and/or bird ownership in European households include Belgium, 71%, France, 63%, Netherlands, 60%, Britain, 55%, Italy, 61%, and for all 17 European countries surveyed, 52%. There is a long-standing myth that people who live alone are more likely than others to own pets because they use them as substitutes for human relationships. But the evidence doesn't support this. Pets, as dog owners know, often serve to promote interpersonal interaction rather than to prevent it. Moreover, people who live alone are far less likely to own a dog or a cat than people who live in couples or in multi-person families. In 2006, for instance, roughly 1 out of 5 solo dwellers had a dog and 1 out of 4 had a cat, while for families of 4, about 1 in 2 had dogs and more than 1 in 3 had cats. The number of solo dwellers with pets is not insignificant, however, and in our interviews, those who lived with a dog or a cat left little doubt about how much they value their relationships with animals. One woman we spoke to, for instance, wondered whether having a pet meant that she shouldn't count as living alone. Another said that owning a dog has been transformative, but mostly because taking care of it has made her leave the house and engage with other people more often. She takes her dog on errands, ties him up on a long leash when she's hanging out in her front yard, even brings him to the neighborhood bar. "I'm chatting with more people on a daily basis now," she reports. "I was more holed up before. The dog really did open up my world." Angelina, who's in her late 20s and works at a labor union, spent years living with allergic roommates. "Getting a cat," she says, "was like one of the reasons I decided to live alone. I got her right away. My relationship with the cat is pretty huge. She greets me when I come home and she keeps me company all the time." Angelina likes the fact that caring for her cat is not especially demanding. "It's hard to clip her claws alone, and it's really hard to get her in and out of her carrier," she explains, "but otherwise it's easy. She can leave the cat alone with a big bowl of food and water if she goes away for a few days. She can shut her out of her room if she brings someone home. Having a one-bedroom apartment has made it perfect, though. She has her own room to play at night." There's a price to pay for maintaining this arrangement with a pet, however. As Donna Haraway, social critic and author of The Companion Species Manifesto, acknowledges, "The relationship is not especially nice. It is full of waste, cruelty, indifference, ignorance, and loss, as well as of joy, invention, labor, intelligence, and play." Then there's the financial toll. Renting the big apartment that makes cat ownership so pleasant has drained Angelina's pocketbook. "If I had gotten a studio, I would have thought twice about having a cat, because I like the idea that I can shut her out if I need to," she explains. "But I'm paying $1,100 a month for this one bedroom, about 45% of my take-home pay. Then there's gas and electric and now phone and internet, all things I would have divided by 3 if I had roommates. So my finances have spun out of control." Ultimately, the big apartment proved unsustainable, as did the lifestyle Angelina had built around it. She decided to leave her job, enroll in graduate school, and move to a cheaper city. That the cat would accompany her was never in doubt. Like Angelina, most pet owners are convinced that they get tangible physical and psychological benefits from their relationships with animal companions, and a good deal of research, though not all, supports this belief. In a survey of the scientific literature published in the Annual Review of Public Health, animal experts Alan Beck and N. Marshall Myers write, "All indications are that companion animals play the role of a family member, often a member with the most desired attributes. For some, pets increase the opportunities to meet people, while for others, pets permit them to be alone without being lonely. The rewards of pet ownership vary depending on the circumstances, but the list of documented effects reported by Beck and Myers includes prolonged lifespan, reduced anxiety and isolation, decreased risk of high blood pressure and heart disease, perceived security, even increased laughter. Animals can also play a role in improving the well-being of people of all ages who are stigmatized, they conclude. In public, some who live alone may feel stigmatized or stereotyped, but when they're home playing with their pet companion, they can hardly feel the bite. The truth is, eliminating the pain related to living alone is no more possible than eliminating the pain related to living. Some feelings, loneliness, regret, fear of failure, anxiety about what lies ahead, are said to be common among singles. Lori Gottlieb, for instance, depicts single women in their 30s and 40s as miserable, while Linda Waite describes the unmarried as emotionally unhealthy compared to their married peers. As people who live alone are quick to point out, however, people who are coupled up or have children or live with friends and family experience no shortage of difficulties, loneliness included. The young adults we interviewed were not shy about discussing the hardships of going solo, but their thoughtful attempts to meet the challenges generated by living alone were productive and often successful. Young adults can and do learn how to live well without a domestic partner, and they benefit from this knowledge when they move in with someone, as the great majority ultimately do. Some, including those who've always thought they would get married, come to enjoy living alone so much that they question whether they could give it up. Perhaps this explains the results of a recent Pew Research Center study, Not Looking for Love. Most young singles in America do not describe themselves as actively looking for romantic partners. Even those who are seeking relationships are not dating frequently. About half, 49%, had been on no more than one date in the previous 3 months. Huang, a professor in his early 30s, recently broke up with a long-term girlfriend and is wondering how to take care of himself. "I have anxieties about living with someone, like a girlfriend or something," he says from behind thick-framed glasses that cannot hide the fatigue in his eyes. "Because I'm cool living by myself, all that self-awareness, comfortable in your own skin stuff." Not that living alone is perfect. Huang does a lot of writing in his apartment, and he often loses himself in a floating-through-space type existence that can feel isolating and lonely. But the rewards more than compensate for the difficulties. "I've learned to enjoy things that I know I've always liked, but didn't really have the time or patience to truly delve into," Huang explains. "Like, I've always had a lot of music and records, but before I wouldn't just sit at home and listen to a record because I would always have another person around. I fear not being able to relinquish what I get out of being single." At times, those who find themselves growing attached to their solo lifestyle sound a cynical note about relationships in general, and their words reveal how far the cult of the individual has advanced. "All you have ultimately is yourself," Huang says. "Something could happen to everyone else in your life and you would end up being alone. So I like the idea of being used to it when I'm still young. I like my friends, but something could happen, something tragic, or our relationships could change. So I try to grow less reliant on my friends and more reliant on myself. Living alone is an embodiment of that." Huang observes a world of divorce, broken families, and failed friendship, and anticipates that the people he loves most will someday disappear. "It's less complicated for me to just live by myself," he explains with a voice full of sadness and resignation. Others who share Huang's view make light of their condition. In Single, a documentary based on the premise that finding and maintaining a lasting relationship has never been more challenging, Several men and women are asked to name the best thing about being single. Not worrying about being broken up with, one person responds. I will not be rejected today, says another. It's easy to understand why some people who have been injured by rejection and separation become cautious about putting themselves on the line in another serious relationship. But when caution turns to cynicism and leads those who live alone to shield themselves in safe houses, the situation can be perilous too. For no matter how socially active, professionally successful, or adept at going solo one makes oneself, there is something uniquely powerful about the intimate connection forged through sharing one's home with another person. Then again, there is also something uniquely painful about sharing one's home with someone who has squandered or abused this intimacy and trust. As we see in the next chapter, one reason so many people separate is that they are lonely with each other. 3. Separating. I grew up in a generation that yearned for romantic passion, yearned as if that was the key to all salvation, to all self-discovery, to everything. Helen, who's in her early 60s and twice divorced, sounds incredulous, if not a bit self-mocking, as she tells me this. We're sitting in the spacious Greenwich Village apartment where she has lived alone for decades, and Helen, a writer and teacher with piercing eyes and a sharper mind, seems completely at ease applying it to her own life. Since childhood, she has seen herself as fiercely independent, but this did not prevent her from subscribing to her generation's belief in the redemptive power of true love, and it shaped her early adult experiences. The yearning for the perfect marriage was odd, she says, because as children in a time when divorce was unheard of, she and her female friends were exposed to the brutal consequences of the vow, "Till death do us part." I remember sitting around my mother's kitchen table when I was a child, and I was surrounded by a world full of internal drama. The drama of unhappy domestic arrangements that didn't have a chance of being resolved. Women were talking about abortions that their husbands were never going to know about. Women were having affairs. They were miserable and they were alone inside their situations. The 1950s and early 1960s were confusing times to become a woman, Helen says. On the one hand, she and her middle-class peers were finding new opportunities in their professions and breaking through old barriers that confined them to the domestic sphere. On the other, they still faced overwhelming pressure to find the right man and organize their lives around marriage. "I was in Europe when I was 23, Helen recalls, "and I wrote these letters to my mother saying, I know I have a great work in me to do, and I want to do it. But I also know that I need, above all else, a loving partner in order to do the work. I was waiting, like every girl in the world, for a man to make a life for me." She didn't wait long. Helen returned to New York and got a teaching job. At 25, in a ceremony at her mother's house, she married a Dutch Catholic artist who, she hoped, would bring out the bohemian in me. He didn't, and the marriage, which Helen calls instrumental, didn't work. "It wasn't bad faith," she explains, "but I married a fantasy, an image. I got married because I knew I needed to have a husband in order to do the work." It didn't take long to learn that her husband could not help her become the person she had projected, nor could she fundamentally change him. "We became real to each other," she says, and together they realized that what they made each other was unhappy. After 2.5 years together, they divorced. Helen held on to her faith in the importance of marriage. She continued dating, and within a few years she had fallen for a Jewish psychologist, the son of communists, someone as different as he could be from her first husband. They were married, again at her mother's house, when she was 32. But despite the different particulars, the result was the same. Helen felt lonely and unsatisfied, and they couldn't make things better. 2.5 years later, she asked for a divorce. "My mother couldn't stand him," she says, "and when I left him, I called her and said, 'Mom, it's over.' She was totally supportive, but she did say, 'Helen, the next one's on you.'" There hasn't been a next one. Some 30 years later, Helen now believes that marriage is fucking boring, and tells me that "I was never more miserable in my life than when I was married." In her view, living alone stands in opposition to living falsely in a conventional but unhappy marriage, just because society tells you to. After Helen's second divorce, she made a tremendous realization. Two, actually. First, she recognized that without these men, I was going to make my own life. Nobody was going to take care of me. Second, and more important, she noticed that a growing number of women in her generation had also been let down by marriage. They were discovering that falling in love and living with a husband didn't fulfill them, didn't allow them to become who they wanted to be. "We fell in love once, and it didn't work. We fell in love twice, and it didn't work. Once that happened, you had experience. And once you had experience, the whole myth of romantic love as salvation came to an end." The men and women of Helen's generation divorced in unprecedented numbers. We'd seen people mismatched, living together in dead marriages for years and years because they dreaded being alone, or they didn't know what to do with themselves, she remembers. They didn't know how to think about their lives. The cultural change that made divorce acceptable was genuinely liberating because it freed unhappy people to search for something better. But it also cast millions of people into an ocean of uncertainty. "It's like anarchy," Helen explains. "After you blow up the family and break up society, what do you do?" Helen and her contemporaries didn't have the answers, and neither did the generations that followed them into the throes of the divorce revolution. But uncertainty about how to remake one's life after separating from a spouse or long-term partner has hardly prevented dissatisfied couples from breaking up their relationships. According to the federal census, today about 1 out of every 5 adults has divorced. And although divorce rates in the United States have dropped somewhat since their peak in the early 1980s, Americans are still far more likely to split up than are couples in all other Western nations. "At current rates," writes sociologist Andrew Cherlin, "nearly half of all American marriages would end in divorce. As a consequence, millions of people who never planned to live alone now find themselves going solo, challenged to adjust their expectations and remake their lives. For many, the solution is to remarry. Americans, ever hopeful, are more likely than people in other nations to give marriage a second chance, and quickly. In the United States, the median time between a divorce and a second marriage is a mere 3.5 years. But a close look at the numbers shows that not everyone is in a hurry to tie the knot a second time. Young divorcees remarry far more often and more swiftly than the middle-aged and the elderly, as do those who live in the South and in rural areas where cultural conservatism, fewer professional opportunities for women, and a less vibrant singles scene make marriage a compelling choice. Overall, remarriage rates dropped precipitously during the second half of the 20th century, even in the United States. In 1950, for instance, 2 out of 3 divorcees remarried within 5 years, whereas in 1989, only 1 of 2 did. And although 80% of women who divorce before age 25 marry for a second time before turning 35, those who divorce when they're older are far more cautious. According to national statistics, only 44% of women and 55% of men who divorced over age 25 have remarried, and a recent American Association of Retired Persons, ARP, survey of people who divorced between the ages of 40 and 69 found that just 1 in 3 had wed again. Why have so many of us given up the supposed benefits of wedlock for the tumult of being single and the possibility that we will spend the rest of our days living alone? One reason is that modern women, untethered from traditional economic and sexual constraints, have discovered that going solo can liberate them from the many unrecognized, unappreciated, and unrewarded responsibilities they still take on as homemakers and caretakers, and allows them to attend to their own needs. The burden of the women's role in marriage helps explain why 2 out of 3 women surveyed in the ARP study claimed that they had demanded a divorce from their spouse. Another reason is that men who are unhappy in their marriages develop fantasies about having a more adventurous sex life as singletons, though the evidence shows that the reality rarely meets their expectations. The booming singles culture of contemporary cities does, however, allow those who separate from a spouse to be socially engaged and personally stimulated rather than isolated and withdrawn. We also opt out of unsatisfying marriages because we cherish freedom, personal control, and our search for self-realization. For both men and women, living alone is a tempting way to achieve these goals. None of this is to say that divorced city dwellers have abandoned their interest in finding another spouse or domestic partner. The great majority of those we interviewed say that they recognize the benefits of being married or cohabiting, at least when things are going well. Separated women tend to emphasize the value of small, everyday intimacies. "I liked the feeling that someone knew me on a day-to-day basis," says Kayla, who's 41 and has been on her own for 5 years following a divorce. "He knew the stuff that you generally hide from others. It's nice to feel the comfort of being who you are around someone else, sharing the things that come out in that unstructured time that just kind of happens, the no-pressure casual time that is so sweet." Dina, who's in her 30s and was married for 4 years, says, "I knew the sound of him coming up the stairs, and this particular way that the door outside our door opens. I miss the rhythm of his steps. It's a physical absence in my life." Madeline, a 61-year-old technical writer from San Francisco, has been happy living alone for 2 decades. Yet she valued the company, the conversation, the sharing, the communication, the knowledge that someone is there. "It must be psychological," she concludes, "because life seems easier if you have someone going through it with you." The benefits are also economic. Both men and women affirm what the statistics tell us, that there are tremendous financial advantages to being married or living with a partner. The ability to afford a larger home or a better neighborhood and to split expenses that are the same no matter how many people use them, like cable, internet, and utilities. The security of having someone else's income and benefits in case you get sick, lose your job, go back to school, or decide to try something different. The luxury of pooling income for savings or blowing it on things that are better when shared. Moreover, decades worth of careful research confirms that most divorces result in a substantial decline in the standard of living for both parties, with women suffering far greater losses than men. Divorced men who are asked about the benefits of marriage tend to bring up other luxuries. Sam, a large and jocular man who, at 60, has allowed his waist to expand and his health to deteriorate, has been single for nearly 3 decades. It's not surprising to hear him say that he now appreciates the way his wife took care of him and their apartment. Like most wives of her generation, she did most of the domestic work. But Sam says he reciprocated by taking over other household tasks, and this, he insists, not only made his home life pleasurable, but also made him a better man. "It's good to have responsibilities," Sam explains. "It makes you perform better. When I was married, I would make sure that the clothes were always washed and there was not a big pile in the corner, that I put away my shoes and washed my dishes. Sometimes when you're on your own, you become lackadaisical on cleaning and taking care of yourself. When I'm by myself, I tend to work, go home, watch TV or sporting events. I become a couch potato. I have a hard time finding somebody to date. Sam is but one of the many divorced men we interviewed who say that living alone has hurt their sex lives. Ray, who's been single since moving from Taiwan to California 8 years ago, says that sex, guaranteed sex, is what he misses most about living with a woman. You don't have to go out there and hunt for it. You're not spending all your energy trying to be a playboy, so you can relax and do other things. I should acknowledge that Ray, who's short and pudgy with neatly combed straight black hair and slightly yellowed teeth, is the only man who used the phrase guaranteed sex to describe the virtues of cohabitation. Others reported that while living with a partner made sex more accessible, it was hardly guaranteed. But in fact, middle-aged men who have remarried are more likely to have sex regularly than those who have divorced and gone solo. According to the ARP survey of divorcees between the ages of 40 and 69, 57% of men with a domestic partner, married or not, said that they'd had intercourse once a week or more during the previous 6 months, compared to 43% of men without a partner. Men with a domestic partner were also 3 times less likely to experience long periods of celibacy. 16% said that they had sex not at all during the previous 6 months, compared to 49% of divorced singles. It's not surprising, then, that single men were twice as likely as their partnered peers to report masturbating at least once a week. For women, the sexual benefits of living with a partner are even greater. Consider how those who have remarried or moved in with a lover answered the ARP survey about their sexual activity during the previous 6 months. 88% said that they had kissed, and 54% said that they had intercourse once a week or more. Compare these figures to the responses from divorced women who had remained single. 18% said they had kissed, and 9% said they had intercourse once a week or more during the previous 6 months. Their responses to the celibacy question were similarly disparate. 17% of remarried women and 77% of unmarried divorced women said that they had not had sexual intercourse, while 42% of remarried women and 81% of unmarried divorced women said that they had not had oral sex either. But they self-report the same frequency of masturbation. Whether coupled up or single, 7% of divorced women over 40 do it once a week or more. Admittedly, the ARP survey does not tell us everything we might want to know about the sex lives of middle-aged divorcees. For instance, many of the divorced women we interviewed insisted that they weren't suffering from their sexual inactivity, because their libidinal energy had diminished as they got older and adjusted to being on their own. "I don't want to be going around in a perpetual state of disappointment and heartbreak," says Sandy, a 57-year-old in the San Francisco Bay Area, when asked about having a sexual partner. "It's not in my life, it's not happening for me, and I suppose if I really wanted that, I could go out and get it, but I don't want it just to have it. I don't feel the necessity of having it." Moreover, the ARP study measures the quantity of sex, not the quality, and some would surely prefer to have less sex with more partners than more sex with the same partner. Overall, however, the sexual benefits of getting remarried appear just as significant as the economic ones. But if the historical trends in remarriage tell us anything, it's that a growing number of divorced and separated people believe that living with another partner also carries substantial costs, great enough to make going solo a more attractive option. There's no doubt that many of these singles are still looking for a spouse or domestic partner, and many single women complain that good candidates, namely men who are looking to pair off with a woman in their age range rather than one much younger, are hard to find. There's more to the story than this, however. In the ARP survey, 43% of women and 33% of men who divorced between the ages of 40 and 69 said that they are now against marriage and unwilling, in the abstract at least, to do it again. Their own negative experiences are one key source of this skepticism, but so are the experiences of others. Between 1950 and 1989, the rate of second marriages that resulted in divorce nearly doubled, a trend that means even those who believe in the institution's virtues have a hard time believing that they can learn from their own mistakes. Kayla, the 41-year-old who lives in Berkeley, is petite and professional, dressed in a sleeveless green shirt and a long patterned skirt that fits with the local style. Although she is open when discussing intimate details of her personal life, Kayla keeps her face turned to the street until the end of our interview, when she gets comfortable enough to show her expressive amber eyes. In her view, the best thing about living alone is knowing that I don't have to consider anyone else. I can indulge my weird little habits. From eating the same thing for 4 days in a row, to watching cheesy TV shows and waking up to read in the middle of the night. And do what I want to do. The other thing she loves about living alone is that she's no longer frustrated by a man who has selectively de-skilled himself out of cooking and cleaning and uses this as an excuse to dump domestic work on her. A lot of men have this fake helplessness when it comes to household stuff, Kayla explains. My partner and I just had different standards, so we'd have the kinds of disagreements that many, many couples have. Charlotte, who at 52 carries her big-boned body with grace and confidence, is an office manager in Manhattan. She married young and had 2 children before divorcing 4 years later, and in her view, the kids are the only good things that resulted from the relationship. She raised them as a single mother and has been living alone since the youngest one moved out 12 years ago. Initially, it was difficult. I had a little bit of the empty nest syndrome going on. It was extremely lonely, and it was scary. I mean scary, like the killer is under the bed or in the closet downstairs. But within a few years, she had overcome these fears. Charlotte moved into a smaller home that suited her downsized domestic responsibilities and turned it into an oasis from the city and her office, where she spends most days dealing with other people's needs. I paint, I write, I read. When I feel like being bothered with somebody, I am. Charlotte has learned to love her domestic autonomy. When you live alone, there's no compromising, she explains. I do everything I feel like doing when I feel like doing it. And it is totally self-indulgent. It's just all about you. It's not that she's a narcissist or an introvert, but after a bad marriage and 2 decades as a single mother, Charlotte feels entitled to put her own needs and desires before those of others. I don't think I want to tend to a living thing ever again, she says. When her children left home, Charlotte plunged herself into the local art scene, and she spends many evenings and weekends going to galleries or painting in a shared studio. Yet she keeps her contacts at a distance. While Charlotte once enjoyed entertaining, these days she rarely invites anyone into her home. I can't manage to have any fun at a party, she admits. It's a lot of work, and I always ask myself, like an hour before people come, why are you doing this? Why? I spend the whole evening being their slave. It costs me an arm and a leg, and now my house is all messed up, and people want to know when I'm going to invite them back. Charlotte still enjoys companionship. She's close to her family members, and occasionally she dates. The most intense relationship she had after her divorce was about 20 years ago. She wound up living with a man, but she calls the experience awful and disastrous, so bad that it put the nail in the coffin and led her to shut out suitors for years. As she approached 50, however, some of Charlotte's relatives worried that she would never find a partner. My mother was warning me, "You need to get out," Charlotte recalls. People start to tell you things like, "You're going to grow old alone," and "You better lock down something now while you can." Charlotte took their concerns to heart. She feared that she'd become reclusive. She wondered what would happen to her if she lost her job or got a serious illness. She questioned whether her self-indulgence had gone too far. One of her cousins always tried to set her up on blind dates, and although Charlotte was usually skeptical, recently she agreed to give it a try. It worked. "I like him," she confesses, as if she's still surprised. "I mean, I don't like everything about him." Charlotte is cautious about the new relationship, but not too cautious. At the time of her first interview, she was spending 2 nights a week with her boyfriend, and things were heating up fast. Recently, he even brought up the possibility of marriage. Charlotte is struggling to make a decision. She enjoys her uncompromising lifestyle, the freedom to do what she pleases, whatever the hour. But she's afraid of being alone down the road, as she puts it, and she worries about the frightening prospect of aging alone if she doesn't move in with someone soon. Her daughter, she says, is worried that I'm going to be old, broke, possibly sick, and maybe unhappy that I've made this choice. Every now and then I get afraid that she's right. Charlotte's predicament is stressful, and she complains about the dearth of wisdom to help guide her decision. She's aware of all the pundits and professors who espouse the value of marriage, and although she hasn't read the studies personally, she knows about the social science literature that claims married people have more economic security and even longer lives. But like many veteran single women, especially those who have been through a divorce, Charlotte doubts that a husband would protect her from the ravages of aging or dying alone. She knows that the odds suggest she will outlive a male partner, and if they are right, then getting married would eventually place her in the stressful and unhealthy position of becoming a dying man's primary caregiver, not exactly a responsibility she wants. During the interview, she shifts back and forth on her options, landing on a note of puzzlement. "I don't know what I'm going to do." Charlotte's concerns about marriage are not unusual among divorced women in her situation. After all, the ARP study reports that usually women do the walking, and in many cases it's because they believe they'll be better off going solo and establishing their own identity than living with a man who might crowd them out. The survey also shows that middle-aged divorcees are more afraid of failing in another marriage than of not finding someone else. Most of the divorced women we interviewed reported that they were open to moving in with another man someday, but only under the best of circumstances. Some insisted that he would have to be self-sufficient so that they wouldn't have to do all the domestic work. Others said he would have to respect their hard-won autonomy and understand that they already had lives of their own. "You become a lot pickier when you're older," explains Madeline, the 61-year-old San Franciscan. "You're just not willing to live with a whole lot of stuff you lived with when you were younger and you've got that primal urge to mate. You sort of self-select. There is a cost to this pickiness." Madeline, who's slim and dressed stylishly in black from head to toe, acknowledges, "I'm not having any sex." But she insists that, "At my age, it ceases to nag at you." In fact, her experience going solo has changed the way she sees her generation. "I always thought that the reason women were alone when they were older was that they were simply rejected. I don't think that anymore. I think they just say, 'I've been there, done that,' and unless you're really something special, you're fine as a friend." Friends play a special role in the lives of women who move into a place of their own after divorce or separation, and the sheer number of people who live alone in contemporary cities means that finding other people who can bond over this shared situation is easier than ever. Although divorcees often fear the specter of social isolation, the General Social Survey, GSS, which is the largest study of American social behavior, shows that single women above age 35, divorced as well as never married, are more likely than their married contemporaries to do the following activities: see or visit a best friend at least weekly, have a non-visit contact, such as a call or an email exchange, with a best friend at least weekly, spend a social evening with neighbors, regularly participate in informal group activities, and be a member of a secular social group. In my interviews, divorced women often said that their friends aren't just companions, but also chosen family, their most reliable sources of social and emotional support. 50 years ago, single women who lived alone stood out in their families and communities. They were odd and unusual, and this made them objects of pity, if not scorn. Today, however, the population of middle-aged adult women who live alone and are likely to stay that way for years or longer is so large that we take it for granted. Helen, for instance, says that when she first lived alone, she felt lucky to be in Greenwich Village, which was full of women in her position. Over the past 40 years, she has watched this scene make its way into the cultural mainstream, and now she believes that living alone is easier than ever because there are more people to keep you company. It's not hard to find them. On the internet, people who live alone, including a surprising number of middle-aged divorcees, use social networking sites to find new friends, romantic partners, and groups of people who share their interests. Contemporary cities are full of singletons who are remaking their own societies, creating environments in which, as Helen puts it, you don't have to feel marginalized or even alone. Feeling lonely is another issue. For no matter how much time divorced and separated women spend with friends and neighbors, they find it hard to escape at least an occasional pang of loneliness, and in some cases the pain lasts longer. Compared to women who live with a romantic partner, women over 35 who live alone are twice as likely to report feeling lonely 4 times a week or more, and about half more likely to report feeling lonely at least once a week. But keep in mind that this does not mean living alone causes loneliness. It's possible, for example, that people who feel lonely more often wind up living alone because they have trouble sustaining intimate relationships of all kinds. Many people, and I'm one of them, absolutely live with loneliness all the time, Helen says. It's like an illness. 10,000 mornings I wake up and just go through the day, and the aloneness is like a cubic force in me in a way. It's dark. Helen has developed techniques for taming these feelings. She spent decades in therapy, and she has trained herself to think and write about her feelings rather than running from them in the predictable ways, whether sleeping around, drinking, or filling time with TV. It's a luxury to spend so much time on herself, she acknowledges. But to Helen, it seems necessary, because the challenge of making herself feel right is so great. In Helen's view, for most of us, loneliness is inevitable. It's part of the human condition, and she rejects the belief that living alone is its source. Like many divorced women we interviewed, Helen copes with her own feelings of social failure, in part, by dismissing the notion that another marriage or romantic relationship would alleviate them. People are in this incredible panic to avoid being alone in the room with themselves, she explains, but their desperation can lead to disaster because there's nothing more lonely than being with the wrong person. Madeline has a theory about why so many divorced people feel this way. When a relationship doesn't go well, it's a very lonely situation. You can't go to the person that you're with for help with this problem because, in your eyes, they are the problem. So you become a little island all to yourself within that relationship, and it's very lonely. The divorced women we interviewed don't deny that, viewed historically, the institution of marriage has helped to nurture children, create communities, and establish powerful social bonds. But they often insist that these common goods generally came at women's expense, and that at this point in their lives they need not worry about them. Moreover, they refuse to romanticize marriage or the good old days, when couples stayed together no matter how much they suffered, and women were locked out of jobs that would allow them to make it on their own. It's one thing to debate the issue sociologically. At a personal level, the real question is, when does life feel better? Living alone is hardly painless, But for many who have endured a failed marriage, it hurts less. Women who live alone are not the only ones who suffer from loneliness after divorce or separation. In fact, women's tendency to make and sustain social connections makes them less vulnerable to isolation than men. According to the General Social Survey findings, men above age 35 who live alone, both divorced and never married, are more likely than men who live with a romantic partner to see or visit a best friend at least weekly, spend a social evening with neighbors or friends, and belong to a social group. But the only one of these activities they do as much as women who live alone is socialize with friends. In every other area, single women are more socially engaged. Men who live alone also have relatively high rates of loneliness. As with women, this loneliness might be the cause rather than the consequence of living alone. They are twice as likely as men who live with a partner to self-report feeling lonely at least one day a week, and about three times more likely to feel lonely four or more days a week. Yet they are rarely miserable. Lou, a 57-year-old attorney and part-time musician who lives in a small ground-level apartment in West Berkeley, has had his own place since his second marriage collapsed 15 years ago, and he relishes the autonomy it affords him. "When you're married, you don't have your freedom," he explains. "You have to think about everybody else and not just yourself. Now I can sit here and watch TV all day long and nobody's going to say boo to me. I can practice my trumpet whenever I want. I have my own space and I feel comfortable in it. Everything about it is how I want it to be." Between work and his jazz gigs, Lou keeps himself busy and he enjoys having downtime in peace. "There's enough in my life that it doesn't bother me to be alone and not going to parties every week. It used to be that I didn't ever want to go out by myself, but now I'll go to movies on my own, go to a Chinese restaurant. I don't have to make plans or think about it. I just go." Occasionally, however, this freedom can be oppressive. "I feel lonely sometimes," Lou confesses. But whereas many divorced women his age devote themselves to planning lunches and nights out with friends or co-workers, Lou has adopted a more passive approach. "I don't spend a lot of time trying to fill up my social calendar. I just take it as it comes." Recently, he's begun to worry that this lifestyle isn't good for him. He has filled his days and nights with work, music, commuting, and television, and the absence of more intimate human companionship, sex, but also simple everyday contact and the rhythms of being in a shared space, is haunting him. "Maybe it's just my doing," he says, "but the fact that I have been alone for so long is probably the biggest failure in my life." Like many men in his generation, Lou believes that he lacks the social skills that he sees in women. He struggles to sustain his relationships with friends and family, and has even more trouble meeting new people or finding dates. When he gets down or lonely, he spends even more time on work and music. "I don't dwell on it," Lou explains. "That's just the way it is." Sam, the 60-year-old who admitted to neglecting his home after he separated, explains, "I tend to not have a social life. I become a workaholic, working way too much, like 140 hours every 2 weeks, and it leaves me very little time for fun." He's a counselor for men in the criminal justice system, and his work is fulfilling because he gets so deeply involved with men whose lives he can help to change. It's also exhausting, emotionally and physically, and at the end of most days he doesn't have much to give. Sam loves music, so occasionally he'll go to a club by himself and just listen. On most nights, however, he's fine being home alone. Still, Sam says that he feels good about his situation. He wishes he lived closer to his three children and his siblings, and holidays can be hard when he can't travel to be with them. He'd like to date more often and would prefer to have more sex as well. But he wouldn't trade places with most married men he knows, and he certainly has no interest in a relationship like the one he had before. In Sam's account of his marriage, things fell apart because his ex-wife insisted on doing things that she knew he disliked, but she wouldn't accompany him to things he wanted to do either. He found himself married to someone who wasn't with him. That was lonely, to be with somebody and not to be. I was all by myself, and I didn't know how to do things on my own. Sam had always enjoyed drinking, but he did more and more of it as his lonely marriage drove him to despair. "I didn't have happiness," he recalls, "and everything I did was for the pursuit of alcohol. It was my companion and my first love. And when I did sober up, I didn't know the person that I had married. I wasn't connected to that person." Divorce not only liberated him, it allowed him to reconnect with himself. Sam has been sober for several decades now. He attends Alcoholics Anonymous meetings regularly and says that, although he lives alone, "I seldom feel lonely because I'm closer to God." This, too, is not an unusual sentiment. As the Stanford anthropologist Tanya Lerman has shown, a growing number of contemporary Christians, including the nearly 40% of all U.S. citizens who identify as evangelical or born again, say that having an intimate relationship with God is a central feature of their personal life. Among all singles age 35 and above, half of women and a third of men report that they attend a religious service at least once a month, and churches have taken notice. Today, clergymen and women frequently offer special ministries for people who live alone. In their book about living alone after the end of a marriage, the Christian educators Herbert Anderson and Frieda Gardner argue that people can enjoy rich and spiritually fulfilling lives if they maintain close connections to God. What is finally distinctive about Christian anthropology, they write, is that the ultimate aim of human life is to be in relation with God. God comes to each one as a friend, and in accepting that gracious offer from God, no one need feel that she or he is all alone. Many divorced men we interviewed feel socially integrated even without a strong connection to God. They may not have as much contact with their friends as women do, but they are far more likely to date and be sexually active, and often they take so much pleasure in the liberties born of going solo that they lose interest in commitment altogether. Stephen,